Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few men who bring more intelligence to bear in that war than our first guest. He is Daniel Horowitz. You're familiar with him, I'm sure, at Conservative Review, and he is one of our go-to guys on a lot of things, in particular the subject of, well, what we call the jailbreak bill. It is a piece of legislation that the president apparently is enamored of now. It's been a bit off and on. Criminal justice reform is the rubric under which it's seemingly inexorably moving forward. Daniel is one of the co-authors, as am I, of a new letter urging President Trump not to go there. And I'm very pleased to have him on to talk a little bit about both the importance of the letter, the arguments it makes, and his assessment of the prospects for this so-called jailbreak bill. Welcome back, Daniel. So good to have you.
Great to be with you. Certainly a lot to talk about.
Indeed. So just very quickly, recap for us the critique in this letter of the bill that the president, as I say, seems to be open to signing if it comes through the Congress.
Sure. Behind every bad bill in Congress is a mellifluous-sounding name. So they give this bill a name. They ascribe to it prison reform. One of them is prison reform. One of them is sentencing reform. Now, when you say prison reform, most people think, well, hey, are they improving the education? Are they improving the quality of the mattresses? Yeah, I'm for prison reform. That sounds great. Really, what this is a prison release bill. It offers numerous avenues for good time credits to early release the most violent drug traffickers. And here's the deal that's important to remember. We're talking about congressional legislation on the federal prison population, not the state prison population. So you can't mix the two together. Those serving time for drug trafficking, not simple possession, no such thing as that, in federal prison, are some of the most hardened criminals that have a long career of armed robbery, sometimes even murder, but they weren't convicted on that. And these are the people who would be released if they're serving time for 15 years. They would get out 5 years early. 10 years, they'd get out about 4 years early. So there's a lot of problems in this bill, as well as a lot of logistical problems with mandates on the Bureau of Prisons, mandating dangerous practices without the manpower and money behind it. This is all designed to basically validate a premise of the left that we don't have a crime problem, we have an incarceration problem. And rather than addressing crime, we need to address people in prison. And there's too many people in prison, and we just need to let go as many people as possible.
Yeah. And when we talk about letting people go, Daniel, is there any prerequisite that it be established these individuals have in fact been reformed, shall we say? Or are they more than likely going to be back on the street doing drug deals, gangbanging, you know, other criminal activities?
You know, there is no evidence that these people, in large part, can be rehabilitated. History has shown when you let them out, the recidivism rate is just tremendous. But the reality is, bill doesn't even force them to do anything new. It takes the existing programs and says, hey, if you participate in them, and a lot of times they already do have to participate in them, so there's nothing new that they have to do. They just get straight up early time credits. And a lot of them said, well, Daniel, this is not sentencing. But that's disingenuous because it's back-end sentencing, because on the back end of the sentence, they just reduce it. And then number two is, Frank, this fight is 3 months old. Since then, they now tacked on the sentencing bill. So that's in there too. So it's the front-end reductions. And these are often violent drug traffickers who have been convicted of firearms felonies in furtherance of drug trafficking. In addition, I need to highlight there's one provision in this bill that just jumped out at me. Remember, you heard the Democrats saying that, you know, there's no excuse for Kavanaugh saying that he committed this crime when he was a juvenile. Now, of course, he likely, very unlikely, committed the crime and it was made up. But in their mind, they wanted to lynch a guy without any due process. We have people that, you know, through a preponderance of evidence were convicted absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt of these crimes. Section 208 of this bill, the sentencing part of the bill in the Senate, would offer those who committed murder as juveniles and they're sitting in federal prison after 20 years an opportunity for a resentencing hearing. So when they tell you this is just nonviolent offenses, that's BS. This is part of a broader movement to let go almost everyone, and they're starting with juveniles and juvenile murderers. And by the way, when you're sitting in federal prison, not state prison, for more than 20 years as a juvenile, likely you're an MS-13 murderer. Because
one of the things that's particularly concern to me is the number of people that are either in jail for violent activities like terrorism, or more to the point, have become converted to jihad while in the slammer. And the idea that some of these characters may get out early as well is really just adding to this point that you're making, Daniel Horowitz, that this is a threat to public safety and needs to be understood as such. Fortunately, I gather much of the law enforcement community, if not virtually all of it, is dead set against this legislation. Is that right?
I've never seen an issue where there was such a wide dichotomy between the political class and the people. Among the political class, you know this, Frank, even our colleagues, I mean, almost everyone on the so-called right is supporting this nonsense. But among the average public, nobody wants this. If you actually explain to them what the bill does, that it's not improving the quality of the food, it's an early release bill. When polled, and there's a recent poll that just came out, the Free Beacon had a great article on this. Should we implement early release for drug traffickers? Right, it wasn't a loaded question straight up. Three quarters said no, and the numbers were strongest among women above the age of 45 with teenage kids. Let me tell you, that is the demographic that Republicans are bleeding, unfortunately, but they need to win any election. It is pathetic to pursue voters that are out of reach, that they're not going to get anyway, at the expense of voters that they usually get, but they're losing now, and they absolutely need, and they're absolutely going to turn off suburban voters.
And by the way, Democratic voters as well, who have the common sense to not want these folks on the street being a threat to them. Daniel, we have to leave it at that. This is an extraordinarily important topic. I congratulate you on your leadership in it and commend to all of our listeners at securefreedom.org the letter that Daniel Horowitz and others of us have signed urging President Trump not to go there on this fraudulent bill, this jihad in jail, problem causing or compounding bill, this jailbreak bill, as Daniel has called it. Please get in touch with your elected officials and tell them you don't want it either. Daniel, thank you. We'll be back to you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Gertz of the Washington Free Beacon about what's going on inside the ring and more straight after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Bill Gertz is in the house virtually. He takes us each week about this time on a tour inside the ring. That is, of course, the title of his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. It's required reading inside the Pentagon and its various rings. He is also the author of 7 terrific books, including most recently iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. You can find his writings practically daily also at the Washington Free Beacon, where he serves as senior editor. Bill, it's good to have you back. I know you've been traveling. Welcome home.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
I understand that your travels took you, among other things, to that garden spot of the universe, Pearl Harbor and Pacific Command, or I guess they now call it Indo-Pacific Command. Before we turn to some of the things that you learned from the trip there, maybe we could talk for a moment about a rather bracing speech that the Vice President made recently about the focus of much of PACCOM's activities at the moment, Communist China. Tell us what the Vice President said and its significance, as you see it, to the strategic situation out there.
Very important speech by the Vice President Pence last week regarding China. He covered all the bases on basically, essentially, the China threat 2018. And he really highlighted, I think, the most significant thing was that the Chinese are literally trying to unseat President Trump in the 2020 re-election bid. We had heard from the president himself that the Chinese were going after the midterm elections to try to undermine political support for the president as a result of his imposition of some $200 billion in tariffs against China. And so this is the Chinese response. In addition to putting their own tariffs in place, the Chinese are going after our political system using what is known as United Front Work Department. That's their Communist Party quasi-intelligence group that is really focused like a laser on influencing the United States and perceptions of China and now it seems to try to interfere in our elections.
Yeah, this unfortunately is likely not confined to kind of influence operations. I think there's reason to believe they will be using economic warfare and other techniques for this purpose as well. Bill, there's much concern, I think it's fair to say, being expressed these days about China's Belt and Road Initiative. We had an interesting conversation the other day with Gordon Chang briefly in which he said not to worry, they're overreaching, it's going to come a cropper for them and create domestic turmoil, by the way, for Xi Jinping as well. But I gather that's not the view at the moment in Pacific Command, is it?
No. In fact, the command is pushing back against the Belt and Road Initiative. They see it as a stalking horse by the Chinese for military expansionism along with economic influence and debt diplomacy, so to speak. I was out in Hawaii recently, and it was brought to my attention that the command has ordered not only the command, but is urging the U.S. government as a whole not to go along with the terminology that China is using. They initially called it the One Belt, One Road Initiative, and because that One Belt, One Road, two ones in there focus so much on China's way, China's socialism with Chinese characteristics plus their military expansionism, the command wants to use that term rather than the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a less threatening. And is the reason, again, in strategic messaging, Beijing is seeking to make it appear more benign than it is. So that's a good sign, I think, that the Pacific Command is urging to really focus on this big initiative, which is going to invest some $1 trillion in mostly in the underdeveloped world in developing infrastructure projects in places like Central Asia and Pakistan and others.
Yeah, with this kind of payday lending quality to the debt trap that is going to turn much of that infrastructure into Chinese power projection assets, it seems. Bill, one of the other things that the Chinese are up to that is very ominous, of course, is perpetuating the North Korean regime and its capabilities to do harm to us. Amidst much talk here in Washington about another summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, there is this note that you've published in the Free Beacons, excuse me, through the Washington 321, the Washington Times Inside the Ring column, in which you talk about North Korea being engaged as we speak in low-intensity conflict against us, a kind of hybrid warfare. What is up with that, and is official Washington not paying attention to that?
Yeah, military sources told me this week that the North Koreans are using this hybrid warfare. And again, we've seen this with the Russians in Crimea. We've seen it with the Chinese using debt diplomacy and others. But in the case of North Korea, they're using a pendulum formula of we saw a long period of confrontation. That lasted from 2014 to around 2016, when they were drove right up to the edge of launching a war with South Korea and the United States. And now we've seen a new peace offensive, a charm offensive. So the pendulum is swinging in completely the opposite direction, and they've held four peace summits just in the last year or so. And so this is really clear. The whole point about all of this, just so there's no illusions, according to these military sources, this is for regime survival and to gain legitimacy in the international community for the Kim Jong-un regime. So that doesn't bode well for the White House efforts to try and get some kind of a denuclearization deal with North Koreans.
Yeah. Bill, at the same one other thing before we leave Asia altogether, there was an arrest in Belgium of a Chinese spy. Tell us about that development and whether it suggests a much more vigorous effort on the part of the United States to crack down on what the Chinese are doing through espionage against specifically our companies.
Yeah, this is an amazing case, a counterintelligence program by the FBI to arrest a active duty Ministry of State Security intelligence officer who has been linked to an aggressive economic espionage program in Ohio targeting American aerospace and aviation technology. The indictment of this fellow who was arrested in Belgium and then extradited to the United States. Again, an unprecedented case of an intelligence officer being arrested overseas and then sent back for prosecution. Now, only one of three companies was mentioned, GE Aviation. The rest are identified in court papers only as victim companies A, B, and C. But again, this is going to be a fascinating case. I'm very concerned that the Chinese will take some action against some of our intelligence personnel operating in China and try to arrange some type of a spy swap down the road. So this is an unfolding story that is going to be very, very important to watch.
Bill, and finally, let me ask you, Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, has apparently begun conversations with our allies in Europe, and I guess to some extent, actually, those in Asia as well, about what the Russians have been doing in violation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Tell us what's going on with that and what you think might come of it.
Yeah, I think there's a big debate brewing behind the scenes within the Trump administration over what to do about the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Again, the problem, as Mattis highlighted to reporters last week, was that the United States is constrained. We can't build intermediate range missiles. That's from 500 miles to 1,500 miles or so. And yet the Russians are violating this. The Chinese are not a party to it. And there are strong pressures from the military to be able to develop U.S. intermediate range missiles to provide a counter to both Chinese INF missiles as well as Russian INF missiles. And the case in point in Russia is they have deployed in fairly large numbers, I'm told, a new ground launch cruise missile called the SSC-8. And this is the missile, of course, the arms control proponents want the Russians to come back into compliance. There's no evidence. It's been several years now of talks with the Russians, and Congress is pushing the Pentagon. They've already mandated research and development on a INF missile that, if deployed, would violate the INF treaty. So I think that's where they're going. I'm told that Mattis, however, is somewhat reluctant. He sees it as a cost issue if we have to go ahead with those missiles, that whole class of missiles. However, the good news is that General Joe Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is in favor of either jettisoning or modifying the INF treaty.
We'll, again, be following this closely with your help. Bill Gertz of the Washington Free Beacon, of the Washington Times, author of InfoWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Check it out, folks. It's required reading. Thank you, Bill, for your time today, as always, and your great service to our country. We're glad to have you home and look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Yigal Carmon of the Middle East Media Research Institute about interesting issues developing in the Middle East and Russia as well. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I cannot express adequately my appreciation and enthusiasm for the time our next guest is giving us. This is an opportunity to reconnect with a man I have admired for decades, truly. His name is Yigal Carmon. He has created in his life after government, that is to say, service in his own government's military intelligence service for 27 years, and service as the counterterrorism advisor to two prime ministers of his country, and his activities for quite some time now have rendered an incalculably important service to all of us. It's called MEMRI, the Middle East Media Research Institute. I've just learned, to my delight, that he has expanded beyond the translation service that he's provided for many of those years in Arabic and Farsi and Urdu and Pashtun and other languages, now also in Russian, so that he's picking up what one of the other big players in both the Middle East and now increasingly elsewhere around the world, Russia, is saying in their own primary sources, to their own people, something that's an incalculably important resource for the rest of us. And Yigal Carmon, welcome back. It is so good to have you. I've missed you, and I really appreciate the chance to visit with you about your important work. Congratulations on it.
Thank you, Frank, and it's, I must say, same here in terms of admiration to your work for many years. And I missed you too. But
good. Well, we're reconnecting.
Taken so us away.
We will be talking more in the future. Let me ask you first and foremost about Russia, as you're tracking it closely with the very skilled eye of an intelligence professional, but tapping into these publicly available sources. To explain what Russia is up to at the moment, particularly in Syria, but vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis Iran, vis-a-vis, of course, the Syrian government itself and Turkey, just what should we be taking away from what they're doing at the moment and what you think they're going to do next?
Thank you, Frank, for the question. This is the crucial question. And let me put it in a very comprehensive way. Unlike all the empires of Europe that turned into regular states, and they're happy with it, the Russians couldn't give up on their dreams of grandeur and glory of an empire. They just can't. I must say, they are a regional power, as President Obama said, but they cannot give up on aspirations to be an equal power to the United States. And all they do, whatever they do, is to attempt to rise up to this level. So we have seen it and we have translated material about it. The whole Middle East and Syria is just one of many spheres of activities where they can rise up to seem to be a global power, while they are not. They are aspiring in many ways, and to Putin's credit, they manage by politics, by low investment, by proxies, by all means to seem to be a global power. Their rival is, of course, America. The dream is Eurasia that stretches, and I'm quoting Lavrov and Putin, from Lisbon to Vladivostok, that far. Everything with Iran, with China, it's all to counter the United States. Even their approach to Israel, which is very complicated.
Yeah, talk quickly about that, though, because this is really sort of where the rubber meets the road at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. So Israel is regarded by them, of course, as a key to the United States, and they cannot afford clashing with Israel. So they and they understand that Israel cannot accept what they have done to enable the Iranians to expand into Syria. And Israel would bomb and showed that it's ready to bomb those Iranian elements no matter what, even if it brings a war tomorrow morning. So they devised a way that they, which is not so, doesn't make the Iranians so happy or the Syrians, but they have no other choice, to coordinate with Israel. This coordination serves them. Because had there not been a coordination, there would be an inevitable clash with between Israel and the Russians.
But let me ask you, Yigal, there was this incident, of course, as you know, in which Israeli aircraft were attacking targets in Syria, and the Syrian air defenses took out a Russian plane. So this is about as close as you get to a clash without having a force-on-force one. So is that coordination breaking down? Is it likely to give way to increased Russian support for Iranian threats to Israel? What do you think?
The coordination is strained for the time because they have to save face and to, but at the end they'll get back to it, or else they will have to clash with Israel, and they know that this clash is not going to be in their favor. I wrote a piece in which I explained that they have to consider the fact that while their systems, the S-400, the S-300, are good in and of themselves, but this is not the final answer. If the atmosphere around is not conducive to keep them in advance, then they will fail. This is what happened, actually, long ago. There is an answer to a very good missile system like the S-400 or S-300, and that is electronic warfare. And they will fail, and they know that. And their system will not be marketable any longer.
Yeah, as you say, though, in this piece, and you can read it, folks, at memory.com, M-E-M-R-I.com, you call it Russia has stopped pretending to be Israel's friend. And so you've sort of described a necessary modus vivendi between the two powers. But is this heading – what I'm really trying to get at, Yigal, is the Russians don't seem to be – restraining their Iranian allies. Those allies are becoming more and more of an immediate threat to Israel and necessitating, Israeli response. And you say correctly, I think, that this is likely to result in a clash between Israel and Russia as well if they're not careful.
Well, they do that regarding Iran because this is against America. Many in Israel even ask, but why would they be against Israel? They don't. They cannot conceive of Putin's to be so hateful of Israel. And I say it's not about. It's like in the mafia. It's not personal. The enemy is America, and whatever they do is to counter America. And the Iranian expansion is part of that whole thing. But I want to say that as I put it in the article, they have declared a war on Israel by the very delivery of the S-300, because who is going to operate those batteries? Not Syrians. They say it goes to Syria. But the Syrians have a long curve to learn how to operate the systems. So until then, who will operate it? Russian officers. Namely, Russian officers are going to be the ones who seek to down Israeli planes. They will not succeed in that. That's another story. Thanks to electronic warfare, which is far more advanced than their systems. But the situation is such that they are bringing themselves into a clash with Israel. And unless they find a solution, you know, they wanted to save face, not to talk to us directly about renewing the coordination. So they said they want to talk to the United States about the delivery of the S-300. Maybe by going through the United States, it's less of an embarrassment.
Yeah. But they've got to do it either way. Igal, you know, we're almost out of time, and I just wanted to ask you very quickly. You have had extensive experience over the years, of course, not just at Memory, but while in the government of Israel, working on and monitoring the so-called peace process. We're told by President Trump that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has come up with a peace plan that will be presented sometime in the near future. I just wonder what you would say if you had an opportunity to speak directly to President Trump before he does this, in light not only of, you know, the sorry experience with negotiations with the Palestinians over the years between Israel and Palestinians, but also this looming problem of a real threat to peace, namely the rising Iranian tide in Syria.
Well, this is one of them, but there is an intrinsic problem with this peace with the Palestinian in the fact that time and again, in the time of Prime Minister Barak, in the time of Prime Minister Olmert, who offered to give back 100% of the territories occupied in 67, and they rejected that offer because it did not include what they really want, which is the right, what they call the right of return, namely a peaceful takeover of Israel in its 48 borders. If the present administration needs an experiment like Barak and like Olmert to realize that the Palestinians talk about Israel, not about the territories, okay, let them have it. They will have it in no time. The PLO doesn't want any solution that is a Palestinian state, and that's it. They want what they call the right of return. They want Israel.
We are out of time. I'm sorry to say, Igal, there's, again, I'm hoping a chance to talk with you in the very near future at much greater length. Memory.org is the place to go for incredible research and analysis. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again very soon.
It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by one of the great investigative reporters in Washington, D.C., has been for many years. His beat has largely been in the national security space and much of it at the Washington Times. He is the author of two terrific books, Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage. His name, of course, is Rowan Scarborough. He's great friend of this program. We're always pleased to have him with us. Welcome back, Rowan. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you, Frank.
I am particularly admiring of a thread that you have been pulling now for some months involving a man I admire and am pleased to be working with a bit. His name is Adam Lovinger. I'd be very interested if you could give us just a quick summary of the sort of Kafkaesque treatment that Adam has been subjected to, initially by the team that was in place under Obama, some of which I guess is still there in the Pentagon and up to no good. Tell us about it, if you would.
Oh, yes, Frank. The Obama holdovers are plentiful in the Pentagon and still very powerful. And, of course, Adam Lovinger is a conservative supporter of Donald Trump. He worked in what is called the Office of Net Assessment, the very secretive group. He goes to the White House to work for Trump on the NSC as a detailer, and boom, all of a sudden he finds out that he's under investigation by the director of ONI, Mr. James Baker, who is an Obama holdover. And the next thing he knows, there's an investigation, and he's suspended, accused of violating security rules, and he's sitting at home now without collecting a salary.
His clearances have been pulled as well, and that was the end of his time at the NSC, of course.
That's right. And he adamantly denies all the allegations that the Baker investigation came up with. And he luckily he found a very good attorney in Sean Bigley, who was helping him pro bono. He specializes in security clearance cases. And in the latest step in this saga is that Mr. Bigley had requested a memo from the people who oversee the people who stripped his security clearance. And they gave him the memo totally redacted, three blank pages, which shows you what's going on inside the Pentagon. They don't want this process disclosed. He protested, and eventually they turned over the three-page memo in which the director of the Washington headquarters services told the adjudicating people that Mr. Lovinger was guilty. So before they even issued an opinion and collected their evidence, they had basically had a edict from the WHS director that Mr. Lovinger is guilty.
And in this case, what you were saying, Rowan Scarborough, is that Adam Lovinger was basically a whistleblower about some things that were going on in the Office of Net Assessment that really are deep state, you know, machinations of the first order. And I gather that both from your reporting and from Sean Bigley, who's appeared on our program, there is a lot of documentation in addition to this this particular memo that Adam has that really attests to his version of the events, and it belies the charges against him and the lengths that this operation in the Washington headquarters staff, part of the key bureaucracy running the Pentagon, as well as his own office under James Baker. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct, Frank. He, before he went to the NSC in the fall of 2016, he sent memos to Baker and other supervisors complaining about how ONI was run, and particularly about these contracts being awarded to friends of Hillary Clinton and to Stefan Halper, who we know was an FBI informant at the time on the Trump campaign, and basically saying that these academic reports are expensive, no one reads them, we need to be doing cutting-edge work, not this kind of work. Then he goes to the White House, and what does he find out? Bang. He's under investigation for security violations that he believes are trumped up, nitpicking, things that they just needed to do to get him out of there because he was blowing the whistle on the Office of Net Assessment.
Right. This Steph Halper reference, of course, brings us to one of the other things you've been reporting brilliantly on, and that is this whole, trumped up charge, I think it's fair to call it, of Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. What's the latest on that as you see it?
Well, I think all eyes now are on this Republican task force in the House. Devin Nunes who uncovered so much about the dossier and how it was financed, and Christopher Steele and how he violated FBI rules. He gave a list of names to this task force. These are people you ought to interview, like FBI agent Stroke, his lover Lisa Page, the FBI general counsel. They've been filing in, and now we have a much more complete picture about how the Hillary Clinton campaign and her Fusion GPS agents were influencing the Obama Justice Department to investigate Trump. That's what was going on. It was a conspiracy between the campaign, Democrats, Fusion GPS, and the general counsel at the FBI, the associate attorney general at the AG, continuing to flow in anti-Trump information, unverified stuff, and then they would send it to the FBI, to Peter Strzok, for him to investigate. And we know some of the stuff, Frank, was just erroneous. Glenn Simpson was trying to sell the attorney general on the idea that there was this special server between the Trump campaign and the Alpha Russia Bank. And everybody knows that that was a hoax theory, that the server was sitting in Philadelphia. It was some sort of a spam operation for hotels. And yet Simpson is sitting down with the AG, with associate AG, and telling him this story is true. You need to investigate it. That's what you call a conspiracy, Frank. You have Hillary Clinton paid agents trying to direct and guide an investigation into the Trump campaign. And I think that's what the president was complaining about this week, that this conspiracy that was going on, which really set in motion this long, long investigation into collusion, which we know there has been no proof of to date. Even, you know, Senator Burr said that a couple of weeks ago, that they have not found collusion to date. Well, it's been over 2 years. You think that they would have found it by now.
Let me turn to one last thing with you, Rowan, if I may. You did have a report recently that I wanted to come back to. We talked about it with Elaine Donnelly yesterday. I think you've got as clear a view of the problem of what's been called social engineering in the Pentagon, especially in our military services. One element of which has been this whole idea of gender integration, quotas even, for women in the military and combat as well as in other positions, which is contributing unmistakably to an increase in sexual, you know, crimes and harassment and the like. And yet it also appears that there is a fairly significant overstating of that problem. Walk us through this, and in particular, what it means for the military that they're spending a lot of time on these issues instead of on warfighting and readiness.
Sure. We know the Kavanaugh hearing produced a constant refrain in liberal media that complaints of sexual assault, false complaints of sexual assaults, are rare. It may be 2% of complaints are ginned up instead of being authentic. And so I wanted to look for evidence of this 2% figure. And one of the places to go is the annual report that the Pentagon puts out on sexual assault. The Obama administration put a lot of emphasis on trying to stamp out sexual harassment, sexual assault, and they began producing a voluminous report every year on the number of complaints, the number of cases, and how they ended up. So I went through the report and found something not to say there is not a problem with sexual assault, but some very interesting numbers that of the 800 or so disposed of cases in 2017 of sexual assault, a quarter of them were, you could extrapolate, were false complaints because they could find no evidence that a crime was committed. So that puts the number of false complaints way above this somewhat mythical number of 2%, and not to take away from legitimate complaints, because there are legitimate complaints, but it does show that the system can be manipulated and people can make false complaints. And to the credit of the military, you know, they put the statistic out there that they investigated and they found no evidence of a crime in about a quarter of the cases.
Fascinating stuff. Ms. Scarborough, you cover it brilliantly. We're always pleased to have you with us. Thank you so much for doing so today, and come back to us again.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.